Welcome to the new edition of Spoiler Alert. I'm Andre Shane.
And I'm Steve Haskin.
And today we're driving around, as always, and talking about the works of Christopher Nolan, one of the top filmmakers right now, as of today, of course. Inception came out a couple of weeks ago, and is the number one movie in America, according to the commercial, Steve. Did you see Inception?
I did, yeah. So today we're going to talk about Inception, focus on that one more than anything else, but also dip into Christopher Nolan's other movies. And
There aren't that many of them.
Themes and working methods and the whole Christopher Nolan extravaganza here.
Exactly. So, Inception, what'd you think?
I generally really liked it. I had a couple issues with it, which seemed like a little nitpicking. We'll get into those in some ways. But I didn't think it was perfect, but it was very exciting. I will say, as a movie that was positioned as one of the only interesting-looking movies this summer, it delivered. I went and I did not leave the theater disappointed. I wanted to talk about it. I wanted to puzzle through, you know, the world of Inception, how it worked. So it's a great movie to go see with people. And if anybody hasn't seen the movie, I mean, you probably want to stop listening immediately and come back to this. But I would recommend go see it. You know, if you see it by yourself, make sure you get somebody to talk to about the movie afterwards. And Yeah,
that's one of the fun things about Inception to me. It's one of those films that people like talking about. Whether you like the film or you don't, and not everybody likes it, it's a wonderful picture to discuss because, there's a lot of intellectual content in Inception. I really want to see Inception the second time because, and this is one of those general things about Christopher Nolan for me, is I find that his films tend to be so dense that they really, really require multiple viewing. It's not one of those things where you could watch a Christopher Nolan film, any Christopher Nolan film that he has made so far, that you could watch it once and really get a complete grasp on what's happening, both in terms of like the explicit plot, but also in terms of the ideas that underline the plot. And there's always a great amount of ideas that underlines the plot. Now, in the Inception, what appealed most to you about the film?
Well, like you were saying, like most Christopher Nolan films, it's a puzzle. The difference between him and, say, M. Night Shyamalan, well, there's a gazillion of them, but you know, he doesn't make movies necessarily with trick endings. I mean, sometimes there's a bit of a surprise at the end, but it's more that the entire film is structured a bit like a puzzle.
Right.
You have to make your way through it. So, as you say, watching the movies the second time, when you already know, you know, the answer, as it were, to the puzzle, then you can better appreciate, you know, how the structure works and the themes underlying the structure. And that's another difference between just having a trick ending. Like a trick ending, sometimes, if you watch a movie that just has a trick, gimmicky ending, when you watch it again and you know it, you know, maybe you're better suited to look for the clues. But that could be all it is. Like the movie could just solely be about fooling you,
right?
And changing. You know, for example, Shutter Island, which we both kind of dislike.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't really know that Shutter Island had a whole lot to say beyond just trying to fool you.
Right.
Which it did very poorly. And Inception, I suspect, because I've only seen it once, just like you, but a lot of Christopher Nolan's other films, you know, even something like Memento, which is maybe the most gimmicky, when you go back, it doesn't just feel that, oh, now you know the punchline to the joke. You can appreciate just how the movie was created, and there are interesting philosophical themes underneath it. That it feels like Christopher Nolan, as a filmmaker, doesn't start necessarily with the gimmick. It feels more like he has some ideas he wants to explore in a movie, and then comes up with a way to explore them.
Right. And one of the things I love about him is that he's a structuralist. He's, you know, the way he structures his films, and there is, it's been said before about him that he's kind of a, he's almost a watchmaker in terms of the way he structures films. You know, he just sort of assembles parts in a way that, you know, where they fit in a unique way. And you know, most of his films have that quality, and that makes him, that to me makes him very, very interesting, because there's so few other structuralists in film. And I think his, the skill with which he accomplishes these little clockwork, you know, pieces that he makes, is very impressive. He's extremely skilled at putting together these little puzzles. And the main criticism that a lot of people levy against him is that it's all about these, you know, he's putting together this jigsaw puzzle, and there's not much more to it than the puzzle itself. And I kind of disagree. I don't think he's a particularly emotional filmmaker, but the way he deals, the way he structures his films is so interesting, so original, and so completely unique right now to the landscape of filmmaking all over the world, that I think the criticism that he is not emotional enough and his movies don't have a heart is kind of a moot point, because his movies are not designed to have a heart. He's not Steven Spielberg. He's not trying to pull at your heartstrings. He's going for something completely different. He's going for a different kind of experience in a movie. And so far, consistently, film after film, he's pulled it off.
Yeah, I really want to get into the emotional versus the intellectual in his movies. But let me go back for a moment, because you asked me what I liked about Inception. I just dodged your question like a shitty politician, which I hate. So my favorite parts of Inception were the cast was uniformly great, which you might expect given the pedigree of the cast. But Leonardo DiCaprio, I'm not the biggest fan of. I thought was great in the movie.
And one of his best performances.
Tom Hardy, is that
Tom Hardy.
Tom Hardy was great. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who I generally do like, was also great. Great performances. I love the pacing of the film. I like that for such an intellectual movie about dreams, it was more or less played like a heist picture.
Exactly.
I very much enjoyed that. And I love that this film really respects the audience's intelligence, that there are complicated things going on in this film. And there's a lot of exposition at the beginning to get you a little bit up to speed, but the film just keeps going. It doesn't pause and over-explain things. And there are times where, you know, any viewer, I'm not saying I'm cleverer than anybody else, but there are times where something happens in the movie that maybe you don't fully understand how it works, but the movie's like, don't worry about it, let's just keep going. You know, it's not going to wait for you. It's,
let's
keep the pace going. And, yeah, so the structure of the film is visually very interesting. Nolan is not a guy necessarily known for his elaborate visual schemes. I mean, nobody's ever, you know, putting him in the same category as Terry Gilliam or Ridley Scott or anything like that. And this is a very, very visual film. And, yeah, so all of that stuff was great.
Absolutely. And it really sort of just dovetails on what I was saying a little earlier, which is the intellectual concept of Inception and other Christopher Nolan films as well. It tends to be fairly solid. Now, he's not a guy who works on a major metaphorical level, although a lot of times there are metaphorical concepts, especially in the Batman films. And in this case, you know, Inception struck me as a little bit, you know, the only metaphor I could really think of in Inception is just the whole concept of this dream creation as a metaphor for the filmmaking process. And this has been pointed out by others. It's not particularly brilliant, but I just kept thinking in those terms when, as I was watching the film, is that he is himself is an architect of this elaborate dream that he's constructing for our purposes. And I was kind of delighted by that small metaphor. It doesn't have anything that changes your life or creates a new philosophy for you, but it's just clever and well done. And another little thing is, on an intellectual level, is I am very, very bad about my tendency to try to guess the ending of the film as I watch it. For example, you mentioned Shyamalan. I've guessed every single Shyamalan ending ever, and that's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily ruin the film. I'm not trying to ruin my own experience. My mind just automatically goes there because I sort of break stuff down as a, you know, as a viewer, as a critic, as a filmmaker. I like to really break movies down, and that's what I tend to do. I have never successfully guessed a Christopher Nolan film. I have never, ever guessed where the film was going. Any one of his films, except for Insomnia, which is a remake, I've never been able to successfully guess, and this was the case with Inception, very much so. I really, really thought he was going to go in another direction at the end, and honestly, I was a little disappointed it didn't go in that direction, because I thought the film ended, well, it ended with me wanting more. I don't know about you.
Oh, really?
I wanted more. I wanted more. I wanted to know, to understand what the actual level of reality, because, well, the implication at the end of the film, the way that last scene is shot, this top that continues spinning, I mean, he basically tells you that the whole thing was a dream. So there's another level of dreaming that's happening at the end of Inception. I kind of wanted to see what that level was and what was going on. What's your take on it?
Well, yeah, we'll have to discuss the whole. I mean, that's not my personal take on the ending, so that's a major thing.
Right, right. But... So you did not feel that at the end of the film that... Did you feel that DiCaprio settled into actual reality?
I basically thought the end of the film was real and that he just cut before the top stopped spinning. I mean, it was wobbling. I mean, it was purposely he left it open-ended. I mean, you know, it's an old director trick that he purposely did not answer that question. So that way you can debate it and decide for yourself.
Right. But,
so I'm saying for me, I pretty much felt like it, you know, that was reality.
Right. Right. See, I didn't feel that at all. I thought that the way the last scene was handled, I mean, first of all, that last scene of the film where, you know, everything is great and Leo comes home to the United States where he's welcomed by his kindly father-in-law and his cute little children who haven't aged a minute since he remembers them. I mean, how long was he gone? He says he was gone for some time. How come his children have an age? It's kind of weird. Second point is, if you remember that scene, it is the only scene in the film that is clearly shot as a dream sequence in the film. You know, the dreams in the film are handled realistically, but the last scene of Inception is absolutely shot like a standard dream sequence. The gauze comes out, everything's a little washed out, there's lots of slow-mo. It's the only scene in the film that's handled as a dream as a standard movie dream sequence, and that sort of leaves me feeling that there's a whole other level of reality. And if you want, I'll tell you what I was thinking throughout the film as where it was going to go. You want me to tell you?
Sure.
All right, I'll tell you. What I was thinking about halfway through the film, I started thinking that the whole time displacement thing is, in fact, like the real reality that, well, first of all, I very early on started thinking that the entire thing is a dream. Simply because, and we talked about this in Shutter Island a little bit, it's a movie about dreams. Generally speaking, in a movie about dreams, the whole thing is going to be a dream at some point. It's a little bit of a cliche, but I think there's really no two ways about it. If you're going to explore the concept of dreams versus reality within a film, you know, ultimately everything is a dream, isn't it? The film itself is a dream. So our reality is to be questioned. But anyway, what I was thinking throughout the course of the film is that Leo is, in fact, a much older version of his character laying in a coma somewhere in a hospital bed, and his grown-up kids are trying to retrieve him out of the dream that he's stuck in. And my theory was that his grown-up kids are, in fact, Ellen Page and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, the boy is older, and therefore it would make sense that he was with him as a sort of established partner for some time. And then the younger Ellen Page is kind of introduced into it a little bit later on by her own grandfather to bring him out of the dream a little more. In fact, at one point when Leo and Ellen Page in the last third of the film enter that that fourth level of reality, whatever it is, or is it the third? The fourth level of reality where that artificial city happens.
Yes.
There's a point where he's walking around and goes, and that's the house where we lived. it. And that's the thing. I swear to God, Steve, maybe I was just hallucinating at that point, but I really thought what he said when he's talking about his wife, whose name is Mal, right? Or Mal, yeah. However he was pronouncing it. But I swear to God, in a couple of takes, he said, Mom. I really heard it a couple of times where he literally goes to Ellen Page, and this is a house where Mom and I used to live in. And it really struck me, and I'm like, oh, it's definitely going in that direction. So when the film didn't go in that direction, I was kind of like, oh, man. I
was
going to
say, I didn't see any of that.
You didn't see any of that. You see, that's great. No, that's a sign of an interesting film, right? You did not see that.
Never for a moment was I ever like, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is his son.
Well, I mean, they look more like Marion Cotillard than Leo DiCaprio. But this is where I was going. And on top of that, if the whole thing is a dream, doesn't this, in fact, leave the thing completely open to sequels? I mean, you could have...
It does very much leave it open to sequels. That you'd, I don't know if he would... I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting film to do as a sequel. I almost feel like if you wanted to do a sequel, you would have to kind of treat it as real.
Well, absolutely.
Because in the larger sense, like, let's say if it's all a dream, mm-hmm. then we don't know if anything... Then that means... I mean, if it's all a dream, that means every single thing we saw could be utter bullshit. And I mean, I'm talking about the whole concept of being able to enter into people's dreams and things like that. Like, all of that, 100% of the movie, would be a construct of Leo's mind.
Right.
I don't see how you could do that, because then in a sequel, I mean, you could just... I mean, that's too open-ended. I mean, you could just release a Rambo movie
it's too vague.
Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Here's somebody else's dream.
But yeah, but I mean,
but I mean, all the technology and just how the world worked, that's another argument for. I mean, you know, I can see the argument that, you know, at the end, is Leo still dreaming or whatnot? I mean, one of the ideas I floated around with the people I saw the movie with was that, you know, that the whole thing is not Leo's dream. That, you know, like, it's all, they really go into the guy's mind, mm-hmm. and blah blah blah. Then one of the theories is that Leo becomes the one trapped in limbo. And we were just trying to work out, you know, similar to you, like with the coma thing, like you're like, okay, so in the, you know, quote, real world, how would this work? And our theory for this is like, say, everybody wakes up on the plane, but Leo. Leo's fucked now. You know, like he's basically in a catatonic state. So, but because they had gone that far, you know, they then send Mal back or something that, I don't know about Mal, but what they then do to help Leo, since he's basically in a coma, is they give Leo the dream of the reunification with his children.
Right.
It's almost like a mercy thing. Right. That, okay, if you're going to be dreaming forever, let's make it a good dream.
Let's create a dream for you.
Yes.
That is a totally viable thing.
All of that, you know, they really did all go to sleep on the plane and had all the adventures, but then Leo got trapped in limbo. And it's, yeah.
And this is what was created for him.
Here's
after
the, like,
he,
heaven dream
But
for
he
Leo.
Would still have to rescue the Ken Watanabe character. You know, so after he rescues him, then Ken Watanabe sort of champions helping him out in that way.
Yeah,
that's also viable. That's completely viable.
It's like then Leo in limbo is dreaming the rescue of the Ken Watanabe character and everything after that. Then he dreams waking up on the plane mm-hmm. and... Because I will say that was another weird aspect about the end is, you know, every other time, you know, in the earlier parts of the movie where you're introduced to the whole entering the dream technology, when people wake up, they're connected to wires and shit.
Right.
And when Leo wakes up on the plane, like, you know, again, you could argue that they took the wires away later. But if it was the way it was supposed to work, you'd think everybody would wake up from the kick with all these wires connected to the magical dream machine.
Right.
And that was not the case. Everybody was completely disconnected, you know, and so, like, right. Well, why is that then?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
we also left, later on I want to talk about, there's fun things to poke holes in.
Absolutely.
Inception. I mean, it's fun. It's like poking holes in the Matrix or something like that. It doesn't ruin the movie.
It makes it more interesting. It makes the discussion of it more interesting, and I love that aspect of Christopher Nolan. I mean, all, like all of his movies, going back to Memento, you know, we both seen his first film, Following, which was essentially kind of a student film, very low budget. But Memento was really the movie that put him on the map. And that movie had a very specific structural gimmick and was also a fun movie to discuss, to also poke holes in. You know, how that whole backwards reality and this the short-term amnesia of the main character and that, like how... Did it really make sense? Could it really happen? And yet, it was solid enough that it works, that it doesn't completely collapse around its own idea. So another kudos to Christopher Nolan and his brother for making these structures fairly solid.
Yeah, no, they hold up. When you revisit them, it feels like a well-crafted puzzle and not just... You know, gotcha at the end.
Absolutely.
Well, what did you dislike about Inception? Because I have some things I dislike. So,
well, I mean, the point that I was trying to make earlier was that it left me wanting more. I don't know if that's a criticism. That could be actually be a good, like, kind of a showbiz motto, always leave them wanting more, and the audience tends to like that. There's not much I disliked about it. I guess it could have been a little bit tighter, I suppose, just a tiny bit. But on the other hand, you're right, it was paced fairly well. I don't think it's a perfect film, and yet it's hard for me to pinpoint specifically what I hated about it. I really, there was nothing I hated about it. It was just some things I questioned somewhat, you know, but that's it. And it was usually very, very minor. How about you?
I had a couple points. I really disliked the score.
I liked it.
I would say I really disliked the nonstop relentlessness of the score, that there were no quiet scenes.
Right.
I mean, I thought the score was great for the dramatic scenes. It wasn't like, oh, this is shitty music. But man, I felt like it never let up. Just never let up. So I'm watching a dramatic running around action scene, and then I instantly launch into this emotional dialogue scene, and the music's still there. And it's one way, you know, at the beginning when you have all this exposition to kind of explain how all this works, with Ellen Page as more or less the audience surrogate in some ways, that, you know, I can see how you need the music to keep it going, but man, I just felt there needed to be way less music, which is probably more Christopher Nolan's fault than the composer.
Right,
that
absolutely.
He put that in. I disliked that aspect of it. I thought it was a little long. I could have done without the final Ken Watanabe old man framing thing. I don't know if we needed that. I thought you could have made the movie work without that. I mean, granted, we're talking that's like 5 or 10 minutes out of this movie, but
yeah, and that was. But,
I just had the sense that when they had the final confrontation with Maul in Limbo, like that felt like that's the climax of the movie. So then, when they're like, "Here's the kick," and he's like, "I'm gonna stay," it's like after I'd already been to 4 levels of dream, you know, like there were supposed to be 3 levels of the dream, and we went to a 4th one where Maul was, and then, you know, so then by that point, just in a 2-hour-plus movie as a viewer, when Leo's like, "I'm going in for 5," you know, I'm like, really? I'm like, okay, I've had enough levels of the dreaming. Like, that's, I thought, okay. The largest aspect I had of it, and again, I really liked it, so this, I don't mean this to seem like I'm, you know, ripping this thing to shreds, but... You know, in the intellectual versus emotional content of, I'll stick with Inception specifically. You know, Leo's, what was this, Dom? Was that his character?
Cobb. He generally went by last name, yes.
So Cobb's relationship with his wife, Maul, was obviously central to the story. You know, like he very much needed, you know, I enjoyed the aspects that he could not control his subconscious, that no matter what he tried to do, she was always entering back into his world. Right. And because he couldn't control it, she would enter in as a destructive force, motivated by his own guilt.
Right.
I mean, that part was great. And I thought, you know, the scenes with the two of them about the relationship worked great. Some of the stuff with his kids, I mean, I thought was a little... I guess schmaltzy. I don't know if that's the word I'm looking for. But it felt plugged in there. Like, we need to insert some more touchy-feely stuff to make Cobb more, I don't know, appealing to certain viewers? I'm not sure. It just, it felt like this is a movie that's basically intellectual, and some of the emotional aspects of it felt awkwardly wedged in.
Mm-hmm.
As if, and I don't think anybody was forcing Christopher Nolan to do this. I think he himself was, you know, like, I imagine him looking at a finished script without some of this stuff and thinking, you know, we need to warm it up a little bit. Right. It's a little cold. And the parts I really hated were all the impromptu psychotherapy sessions between Ellen Page and Leonardo DiCaprio, where, right. you know, I mean, again, out just with the relentless pace of the movie, which I generally liked, but, you know, it's like, bam, 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 action, bam. And then suddenly she's like, hold on, I want to make sure you need to confront this difficult emotional truth about yourself that you're not sharing with the rest of the team.
Right.
Where I felt, you know, the proper response from Leo's character should have been like, hey, little girl, why don't you shut the hell up? I just hired you. You know, like, why don't you mind your own goddamn business? Because I'm your boss and you've been here for 1 week.
She needed a spanking.
Yeah, too, and it was weird.
That's because she's his daughter.
Well, it felt really awkward and wedged in, and Ellen Page wasn't really, I mean...
Her heart wasn't in it?
That's not what I meant. What I meant was that it's awkward lines of dialogue.
Yes, she had a lot of...
I mean, Meryl Streep would have had a hard time pulling some of that stuff off. But that was weird. So it really made me, as the movie went on, start to dislike her more and more, because I just... That was the stuff I didn't want. Like, how you were saying that... I don't necessarily want more emotional aspects of this movie. I would have been fine. Now, I kept thinking about The Matrix. You know, like, The Matrix, I love The Matrix. The Matrix had some philosophical underpinnings, probably not as deep, but, you know, like, I love The Matrix. Now, would you have liked The Matrix more if, say, we also had a subplot about Keanu dealing with his abusive stepfather? I mean, like, we didn't need it, right?
No.
I mean, like, you don't need that.
Now. No. And that's Matrix
what I felt,
was tighter.
That's what I felt a little bit with this movie, that they really piled on some of the, like, tormented family aspects more than they needed to.
Right. Well,
now, I will also say, again, like, acting can go a long way. Similar to Ellen Page was not selling that stuff, Marion Cotillard and Leo, like, really did, like, sell their relationship. You know, and the constant scene of where he comes into the hotel room and all the furniture smashed and she jumps.
And the payoff to that emotionally
is great.
And
both,
I agree.
Yeah, great. Agreed. Okay.
Well, that's, you know, I think that's very valid. I kind of agree with you. I do have to say that sort of a personal journey, like an emotional shortcoming of the main character that then ends up sabotaging the viability of the mission is a fairly common plot point in a lot of heist pictures.
Sure.
You know, like even if you take, like, the most popular heist picture of recent years, Ocean's 11, there's an aspect, you know, Danny Ocean has a thing with Julia Roberts, and that continually presents itself as an obstacle to their actual heist that they need to accomplish. So this had kind of a similar thing, even though this was a little bit more overwrought and presented a little bit more dramatically than it was in Ocean's 11, certainly. But I would agree with what you're saying on all fronts, except it just didn't bother me as much as it bothered you. I agree that the music was relentless, but I like the score of the film. And also, music has a good way of propelling the story forward for when you have a 2.5-hour movie. That kind of helps. Music kind of makes it move along.
Sure.
and makes the time, makes the entire thing feel a little bit faster. But yeah, all of these things though are still add up to a pretty great picture.
Yeah, those are the things I mentioned are more. It's not even so much major flaws. Those are the reasons why I'm not like, wow, masterpiece.
Right.
You know, like it's not my favorite movie I've even seen of the year.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really good.
Right.
I still think you should go see it. And it's, you know, I love this small movie, Winter's Bone, but there's not nearly as much to puzzle out about.
Right, you know, like that's just a solid, like, low-budget film.
Yeah,
just
and
works.
I thought it was great, but, you know, afterwards I'm not sitting around trying to figure out the technology used in the movie and what that meant.
Right. There's so much to ponder in this film.
And there's great, just as a viewer, there's simple, you know, the movie is action-packed.
It is.
There's a lot of great set pieces. I laughed out loud at the snow section.
Right.
And I just applaud the imagination of, you know, why not? Why? Like, all of a sudden we're in a James Bond film.
Absolutely. I mean, he explicitly put us in the middle of a James Bond film because again, it's you know, these type of films are ingrained in our subconscious. So why not have that part of somebody's dream?
Yeah, and it's more fun that, you know... It's like, say, the second level of the dream, which is all in the hotel world. Like, you know, that, when it lost kind of gravity, made it more interesting and spinning.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, it's like, yeah, if you're going to different dreams, it's like, you know, why don't we have one of them underwater?
Absolutely.
But one of them on Mars, you know?
Well, that's sort of what I'm saying, where I think that this concept is so potent and so malleable that you could have a whole series of Inception films using the basic concept.
Well, you would have, that's what I mean, you couldn't have Leo dreaming anything through the whole movie.
No.
Is what, but yes, if you bought that the rest of that stuff was real, that you can enter dreams and create the world.
Absolutely.
You're
you
right.
Have to go with that.
It's almost an unlimited template.
It's an unlimited template for films, for various plots. Now, there was a film that came out that had a similar plot line, I have to say, lest we somewhat set it, you know, oversell the pure originality of the dream concept, is that there was a film called The Cell with
J-Lo.
What's her name? J-Lo, that came out a few years ago, that had a very similar concept, the ability of, to enter someone else's dreams. And that movie handled that the dream sequences in a this crazy, phantasmagorical way. I like that picture. But what I liked about Inception was the way it was willing to handle dreamscapes in a fairly pedestrian manner, and a lot of people criticized that about Inception. They said, well, you know, if you're going in somebody's dreams, how come everybody's dreams are so basic, so pedestrian?
Yeah.
And I don't know, Steve, like, when I remember my dreams, usually they're also pretty pedestrian.
And they're fairly realistic.
You know, my dreams, I never dream, well, I shouldn't say never, but I almost never remember dreaming of some insane other planetary dreamscapes. My dreams half the time involve me, like, hanging out with my wife or, you know, just working. I have tons of dreams where I'm on a job and I'm doing stuff.
Yeah, a lot where suddenly you're a hang glider, you know, flying assassin.
Absolutely. Very rarely does that happen. Now, sometimes in dreams, also, you know, in a sort of standard environment, something crazy happens. Like,
sure.
All of a sudden, I'm at work, and the next minute, I'm, you know, horseback riding with a bunch of cowboys. That happens, too, out of nowhere. And you don't really question that within the dream, which is why I like the way he approached dreams as a fairly realistic thing. He didn't try to knock your socks off with too much fantastical elements,
and
that was I thought that was actually original.
Well, in some ways, one of his best ideas structurally was, if you know, the initial genesis of this movie was about dreams and different layers of the subconscious and being able to enter dreams, the decision to structure it like a heist picture, I think, was great.
Absolutely.
I mean, that was really interesting, and there's almost all the elements of traditional heist pictures.
Absolutely.
You know, there's the goal, there's assembling the team, like you say, there's the team leader or member who could, you know, compromise the mission because of emotional complications.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the rookie member of the team, there's the old guard, there's always who can you trust, you know, there's the person that who's providing the money who they don't quite trust.
Right.
And it was all
It was all there. It was all there. But, and, you know, the great thing about a heist as a genre is the heist genre also gives you an easy shorthand for introducing and developing characters.
Sure.
Characters are essentially given a code, you know. So you got the architect, you got the chameleon, you got the thief, you got the chemist. Automatically, you take the, so rather than build these characters from scratch, you're just sort of going like, okay, there you go, there's a character, and that's what they do, and then the actor sort of fills in the rest of the pieces, making it you know, making it very economical in terms of storytelling. I really like that technique. And friends of mine have criticized the film's heist thing, saying, well, it's basically just a standard heist film with nothing else going for it. I disagree. The heist film is just a structure. It's sort of the foundation on which the film is based. But really, it's so about so much more than the heist. And it's about so much more than, you know, the mechanics of the heist. And also, I have to say, the concept of planting an idea, the inception itself, planting a germ of an idea into somebody's brain and having that germ develop is very interesting. It's a very interesting sort of science fiction, Philip K. Dick type concept that really is, was explored well in this film, but also has other possibilities. I mean, think about it. I mean, if you could really implant ideas into people's brains, my God, you could rule the world.
Well, we did afterwards, a friend of mine and I joked that in terms of doing that, it really seemed overcomplicated, and we wondered if they could have just put some headphones on Cillian Murphy and just constantly repeated the phrase, break up the company. You know, like maybe a couple nights of that, and maybe that would have had the same effect, and
right.
Nobody would get hurt, and it'd be a hell of a lot cheaper.
It would, but it wouldn't be as entertaining for film-wise.
It'd be a shorter film.
Absolutely, much shorter. But
I want to take a minute and talk about some of just, assuming that it's not on Leo's head, how mm-hmm. it worked. Because mm-hmm. I was curious about, like, in every level of the dream they went in, they still needed the dream machine. You know, the thing with the button they all, and they needed a babysitter. Well, now, is that all just within their minds in the dreaming? Because in theory, you would only need one dream machine, right? The one on the plane.
You would need the dream machine to physically, and the dream machine was seemed to be really just a, just really sort of injected chemicals into people and knocked them out. Right?
Well, and had one of those cool, like, almost like a Staples It's Easy button in the middle.
Mm-hmm,
that you can
that's
slap.
Exactly what it was. That's right. Push the button and you go.
Because, I mean, once, if the plane's the real world, then once they do that, everybody's dreaming. So it was funny to me that within the dream, they still had to hook up. And they also, you needed a, similar to, from what I've heard, if, say a bunch of people are sitting around doing heavy drugs, maybe you want a babysitter to make sure that nobody kills themselves.
Uh-huh.
You know, they still had that in every level of the dream. And one of the things I thought was interesting as a choice is before, you know, the heist, before it started, I kind of assumed the chemist would be the babysitter. And we would have, you know, standard drama of, okay, the chemist has to protect everybody sleeping.
Right.
To make sure, and there'd be some sort of drama about can the chemist keep them from being disturbed. And there was that exact scenario, but it didn't happen in the, you know, the supposed real world.
Right.
It happened a layer deep.
Yeah.
So the ultimate guardian of everybody was the unnamed stewardess.
Right.
And also, if you're like, if that's the only level that really matters, then the mission went 100% smooth, right? I mean, nobody ever interrupted. Nobody tried to break into first class.
Right.
And, you know, they just
slept. Well, Ken Watanabe bought the airline, so he basically stacked the deck that
there
everything
were no
was
flaws.
Safe. Yeah, absolutely. Watanabe's people.
The stewardess
took care of all that
injected
stuff.
The drugs, and then I don't, you know, did some Sudoku or something, and
there you go. Well, it was an easy gig for her. Everybody in the, you know, usually there's a stewardess specifically assigned to first class, and in this case, it was an easy gig. She probably just took a nap.
Didn't have
herself.
To serve drinks.
Didn't have to do anything. It was fantastic. Everybody's passed out. You're good to
but
go.
If you think about that in the movie, that's a lot of power for a character that doesn't even have a name.
Exactly, an unnamed character. I don't even remember what she really looked
she
like.
She could have really just
much
compromised
like in a dream.
Everything. Yeah.
Very true, very true. But again, it just opens up some interesting things for the sequel. And Steve, I'm telling you, there's going to be a sequel to this film. I'm sure of it.
I get
especially
it.
Now that it's a big hit.
Yeah.
And I think and I think for sure that even though nobody actually talks about it for some bizarre reason, but you know, I'm sure Christopher Nolan thought that there would be a sequel to this film. It is not designed as a sort of a closed-ended, you know, end of story narrative. I think it totally sets itself up for additional films. And
the only thing about that is, if he does that, he will have to definitively answer some of the things he left hanging.
Yes, he does, and that's what sequels are good for.
That's true.
Sequels are very
good
for
like
that.
Well, I just mean, if he enjoys, you know, obviously the ending of this movie was structured in a way to let people, you know, make up their own minds. Like, mm-hmm. there's not a definitive, inarguable, like, here's what happened to Leo's character. If you make a sequel, you do have to kind of answer that. Like, you know, yeah. did he in fact get back together with his kids? Mm-hmm. Was that a dream?
Yeah, but, and I think that could be the whole concept of the sequel, of answering those questions. Let me ask you, is Inception the best Christopher Nolan film, in your opinion? And if not, what is?
Well, the short answer is that I'd have to see it again, but probably not. I've recently reviewed a lot of Christopher Nolan pictures. It's the most complicated, I would say.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, with the just right. different levels of dream. It's far mm-hmm. and away the most intricate. It's not my favorite. In terms of the most satisfying Christopher Nolan films, I would have to go with the two immediately before this. Either The Prestige or The Dark Knight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've recently rewatched most of those. Recently rewatched Christopher Nolan's films. I have not seen Insomnia, but I saw Following for the first time. I saw Memento and The Prestige again, and I'm pretty familiar with the Batman movies. And, yeah, well, first of all, it's seeing them all stacked up like that, it's a pretty impressive body of work.
I agree with you.
And not a dud among them.
No.
And really delving into the intellectual versus emotional aspect, Christopher Nolan reminds me a little bit of Kubrick. I mean, not a lot. He's not like a Kubrick clone or anything like that. But Kubrick was a very intellectual filmmaker. Like Kubrick, it seemed, most of his movies were designed almost in a similar way. That Kubrick had a philosophical idea he wanted to explore and then looked for a way to do that in a movie. You know, whether it's through a horror film or a science fiction film or a war film mm-hmm. or, you know, like...
Virtually any genre. He's
yeah,
done them all.
He has done them all, but I felt like that was the start. That, you know, like Spielberg, for example, is supposed to be like, Spielberg is like, I want to make an alien film. And then that leads to War of the Worlds or, you know, or I want to make a sci-fi film and that leads to Minority Report.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not critiquing this way, but like, that's what Spielberg does. Spielberg is almost more like your average moviegoer.
Mm-hmm. You
know, like, I'm in the mood for a Western.
Right. Here it is.
Whereas, like Kubrick, Nolan seems to be like, I want to make a movie about, you know, shifting consciousness. And what's a good movie structure that will allow me to make a movie about that in a way that people will actually watch it, as opposed to just me lecturing people about shifting consciousness.
Right.
And the difference is that Kubrick, you know, was often considered a cold filmmaker, like not particularly mm-hmm. emotional.
No.
But Kubrick seemed to not give a shit. Like, Kubrick is like, here's my cold intellectual movie, it's fascinating, you know, I'm not really going to try and wedge in, like, a warm, friendly character, you know, I'm in the middle of 2001, you know, there's a little bit with somebody's daughter and that, but he wasn't overly concerned with, you know, how likable the astronauts were. And Nolan, I think, is concerned about that stuff, and he's constantly trying to find a way to make his movies more emotional. I read some quote from him in a magazine where, you know, when he started out as a young filmmaker, he was distrustful of emotion. And maybe it's the Britishness, or maybe it's just, you know, when you're young and cool and hip, it's not often cool to just talk about, you know, people crying and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he made the Batman movies, he might have been forced into some of that. You know, like, for all I know, the love interest characters in the Batman movies, like, it's probably not his idea. Yeah, so he had to deal with it, and he's like, oh, maybe I've... He tried to get better. Inception, I don't think he really pulled it off, but, you know, Memento, for example. Memento is about this character seeking revenge for his wife, and you buy the whole revenge plot, and some of the scenes with his wife are affecting, but, you know, the character's not particularly likable. Like, you know, you mm-hmm. watch that movie, and you want to know what happens, because you're fascinated by the structure, and you like the plot, and it's interesting. But you're not really emotionally with the character. Like,
right.
Man, I really hope he gets some sort of closure and salvation.
Well, not, even more so, in Memento, what you have a lot of times, you have a certain degree of horror about what this guy's actually going to do. Because, you know, what you have is the concept of the unreliable narrator, which is a constant in a lot of particularly film noir type films, and it's safe to say that film noir is a huge aspect of what Christopher Nolan does, certainly in that film, and he just takes it to the upteenth degree, where the character is so unreliable because the character himself is not sure what the hell is going on at any given moment, that you're actually kind of horrified at the notion of what he's going to do. And because he does, in fact, commit a murder in that film, and a murder that's, you know, only vaguely justified. I mean, he's basically a murderer. It doesn't bode well for your identification with Leonard, the main character of that film, because he is so unreliable, because he is mentally ill, and then he ends up just doing things for his own gratification that really are not justified by, you know, what's actually happening. A lot of it is, you know, he's not just a man suffering from a mental disorder of, like, short-term memory loss. He's also a psychopath.
Oh, yeah.
And that's for a character, that's an interesting twist in that film. I didn't see that coming either.
I mean, for a character who seems to spend his life guarding against people using him, he's just unbelievably easily manipulated.
Yes.
I mean, you know, he's so proud of his system of Polaroids with notes, but then it's like, all you have to do is convince him to write something on the back of a Polaroid, and then he'll treat that as, like, the word of God.
Exactly. You know, well, it is, yeah.
I mean, it's not really all that tricky.
That's what it comes down to. And Memento is it's a very gimmicky film, because it's sort of structured in reverse and uses a lot of these techniques that I often find annoying, which is repetitiveness, scenes played out a couple of different times. I've always found that gimmick annoying, but I didn't particularly like Memento the first time I saw. But on subsequent viewings, I liked it quite a bit. And that is a constant with Christopher Nolan. His movies do demand multiple viewings, and Inception certainly does. And, you know, my favorite Christopher Nolan film, I think, is The Prestige, actually. And that movie severely requires multiple viewings, because there's bizarre implications to what's happening. And it is a little bit hard to wrap your brain around what that movie does without seeing it a couple of times and really understand what's happening and kind of moral implications of that. I'm a huge fan of The Prestige. I think everybody's great in it. Performances are excellent. I think Christian Bale is just excellent in that film. Does very, very subtle
work. That film has the best emotional payoff.
It does.
The human relationships in that movie are the best of any of his movies. That you really, you know, I mean, you can argue they're not central, just like all his movies, but I really do feel for, you know, I have emotional attachment to the characters in that movie.
Well, to more virtually than all the characters. I agree with you. I mean, I have emotional attachment to, like, Andy Serkis's character in that movie. It's weird, you know, and I think overall that's probably his most successful film. But again, I need to see Inception again. And it's very possible that with time, Inception may become my favorite Christopher Nolan film. I don't know. I kind of doubt it at this point, but it's very, very possible. And but again, I'm really looking forward to seeing it again, which is always a good sign for any film, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's really an amazing feat to have a movie that's complicated and makes you want to see it again, mm-hmm. and rewards multiple viewings. And, you know, I will say, we in the future, Andre and I have discussed doing a podcast about some of the directors, the new breed of directors. Specifically, there was a lot of directors in the late 90s, early part of the aughts, where we thought we were in a new golden age of cinema. Like, you know, is this the next group of Scorsese, De Palma, Spielberg, all those guys? And out of all those, you know, if you had asked me in 2001, like, hey, who do you think's going to be a major director in 2010 making really interesting movies that you can't wait until their new movie comes out? Okay, here's your choices. Bryan Singer, Sam Mendes, M. Night Shyamalan, and Christopher Nolan, the guy who made the gimmicky backwards Memento movie.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I would not have put my money on Nolan.
No.
And
he's emerged that.
Clearly among those other three directors I just mentioned, I mean, does anybody argue that he's you know, certainly the most interesting of all those guys.
No, no question about it. Not only that, I mean, in terms of both success and ambition, you know, Christopher Nolan may be the top director in the business right now.
That's it, period. He's a money-making machine.
I don't think there's anybody. I think he had a good deal of success with, you know, even with Insomnia, theoretically. But once he got the franchise, once he got the Batman franchise, which, incidentally, talk about hitting it out of the park. Batman Begins is excellent. It's absolutely one of the best superhero movies made at that point, where he takes the subject matter, he treats it with seriousness, gravity, intelligence, and also makes this kind of quintessential post 9/11 film where you would go, wow, it's interesting that one of the, you know, most insightful and interesting commentaries on the real world that we live in is going to be made in a Batman movie. And that's a great accomplishment. And, of course, the follow-up, Dark Knight, what can I say? I mean, that movie, again, grows on you with multiple viewings. Very complex. People underestimate it a lot of times. I kind of underestimated it the first time I saw it. But as I watch it again, there's things that strike me over and over again and new things that continue pop up in it that kind of continually surprise me and make the film so watchable on multiple viewings and multiple levels. It's really, really an amazing accomplishment. A lot of kudos needs to go to Christopher Nolan for picking up this franchise, which could have been just hacked up just like every other franchises for the most part, and just doing a fantastic job with it.
Yeah, I mean, and The Dark Knight is, I've said this many times to many people, but that is one of the strangest, darkest, most violent, disturbing mega blockbusters you will ever see.
Yeah, I've seen
movies that maybe are weirder and darker than that, but not movies that grossed $1 billion. I mean, I remember the first time I saw that movie, I almost felt like I was hit by a truck watching that thing, and I came out of it going, "Wow!" I mean, well, it's cool. I guess it'll make some money, but man, that's a weird film to be your summer tentpole movie.
It is, yeah.
Apparently, not just America, but the rest of the world was like, I'm in.
Yeah.
And people went multiple times.
It is stunning. I mean, it was certainly cool and action-packed and so on and so forth, but I kind of felt the same way as you did. I mean, this was a dark, dark movie. I mean, it is called The Dark Knight, but nonetheless, I mean, it was really dark, it was really disturbing, and it was incredibly dense. It was just hard to sort of grasp it all in one or even two sittings, I would say. I think that movie actually requires serious multiple viewings, and I think its reputation has just grown over the years. It hasn't been one of those films where people go, oh yeah, sure, yeah, Titanic made $1 million, it gives a shit, you know.
Well,
it made $1 billion, but you know what I mean. So yeah, that's again an incredible accomplishment, worth the kudos. Christopher Nolan is the real deal. What can you say? A real, real brilliant filmmaker. It's great. I love the fact that there's a Chicago connection to him. I love the fact that he brought the Batman films to Chicago, where I think they belong. I'm just excited to see what he does next and where he goes next. It's very rewarding for me to have a filmmaker like Christopher Nolan out there working not in obscurity but at the highest level of success.
Yeah, it's exciting to have a new member of the Masters Club, as it is.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what can you say? Again, I really want to see what he does next.
So, hats off to Christopher Nolan. We both recommend Inception. All his movies, I guess.
That's right, we do. And really, if you did like Inception, or even if you didn't like Inception, A, you should give it a second chance, and B, definitely check out some of his older films. They're definitely worth it. The guy has not made a bad film, and that's saying something. The guy just has an excellent, excellent track record up to now, and he may not be successful 100% of the time, but by golly, he tries.
I guess that's about all we have on
that
Christopher
Nolan.
That
is all I have on Christopher Nolan. Thanks for joining us on Spoiler Alert. I'm Andre Shea.
I'm Steve Haskin. And we'll see you next time.